lift mechanism under the rostrum caught on fire. Mr. Frost, the unofficial poet laureate, could not complete his verse. Microphones gave out uncertain amplification. Cold and snow forced an abbreviation of the festive parade. Yet despite snarl and snag and snafu, Inauguration Day was a resounding, one must almost say, an astonishing success. Why so? Largely because of the address of our new president. We had read so much of the store which he set by this address that I feared it might be overwritten and overdrawn. But it was not. It was an eloquent, yet simple, honest, straightforward piece of work, effective as an address, effective as a statement of the American position, the American spirit, and the American commitment. It was serious without being self-righteous, strong without any trace of bombast, sober without being oppressive, and giving to the American people a much-needed lift, a challenge which they could meet in the immediate and the far future. Mr. Kennedy can be proud that he made America proud of the way he accepted the highest office in our land. But what now? What does he face? What do we face in the next 4 years? What challenges and crises and opportunities exist for us today, tomorrow, and in the proximate future? The first challenge which all of us will have to face is an economic one. Symptom of that challenge are the two recessions which we have now suffered back to back in the last 3.5 years, the latter of which we have not yet surmounted. Perhaps we have not yet plunged into its fullest depth. Why these recessions? It's difficult to say. In part, apparently, because our standard of living has so outstripped that of most of the rest of the world that we cannot compete in many markets of low economy. In larger part, perhaps, because of a more serious problem. Because we can now, with our machinery, produce more goods than we can use or that we can sell, and we can produce these goods with less men than the sum total of all those who need work. It is a paradox, but nonetheless serious, that our genius for production faces us with a threat of overproduction, and faces us with a long-range threat of high-level, chronic unemployment. 5.5 million Americans are this day out of work. Many have been out of work for extended periods of time and have exhausted their unemployment relief and compensation. 4 million Americans, nearly one in every 50, must piece out their provision by receiving foods from the federal dole. This in the land of supreme abundance. This in the land whose prosperity is legendary, whose wealth defies the wildest dreams of the Caesars and the Czars and the Pharaohs of old. And in his sober, reflective task force report to the new president on the prospect of our national economy, Dr. Paul Samuelson, scholar economist, predicted that it was altogether possible that despite immediate efforts to pump prime, to give added relief to areas of chronic unemployment, it was altogether possible 7.5%, another million or more people, might be out of work within the next 6 months. Now, such a condition is an unacceptable one to a nation which is founded on principle. It cannot be tolerated. Unemployment means not only the draining of one's savings, personal hardship and frustration, but ultimately it means the exacerbation of the political scene. For those who are unemployed are actionists. They are extremists. Indeed, they must be. And if we wish to see our democracy secure, and if we have any heart sensitive to the suffering of others, then we and the president must take an active role in curing this serious social ill which besets our economy and our people. And if I read Mr. Kennedy's views correctly, the speeches which he made during the campaign and the promises which he has made since, I am convinced, I know, that he will not tolerate this condition, that he will exert every energy and ability that he has to cure it and to rectify it. The first executive decision he made when he assumed office was to double the ration of food which was sent to those who were undernourished, whose diets were substandard. He promised in his first press conference to submit to the Congress this week, perhaps to even indicate in his State of the Union message tomorrow, the specific measures which he intends to enact, which he hopes will be enacted, to serve the national good, to solve this recessional unemployment problem which awaits us. We do not know the details of this program, but if he follows closely those which he has already publicly suggested and those which Dr. Samuelson suggested to him, they will include some subvention to the states that their relief coffers may not run dry, direct aid to distressed areas, encouragement of new business for those areas, the establishment of vocational organizations to retrain and relocate workers who cannot be now employed, some reducing of the interest rate, some restriction on American investment abroad to staunch the outflow of gold which is so troubling our country, some statement as to the soundness of our dollar, that we can continue to use the dollar as a favorable means of exchange in the markets of the world. This is at least part of his program. This is a program designed to grapple with the symptoms of the disease of overproduction and unemployment which he faces. And it is, as far as it goes, a good program. It is a program in the typical tradition of American political statesmanship, pragmatic, humane, designed to meet each problem as it arises, rather than some program which follows out a doctrinaire theory of economy. Those who expected the president, the new administration, to hew out some entirely new economic philosophy will be disappointed. Mr. Kennedy is not to the right nor to the left of Mr. Eisenhower, but ahead of him. Ahead of him in the sense that though he promises new directions, what he is really speaking of is a new directness, a new direction of all executive energy to meet the challenges of the marketplace and of our economy today. He intends to step up the administrative concerns of government, to use the powers which now lie with the government more carefully to scrutinize and to supervise business, corporations, the average individual than has heretofore been indicated. The Landis report on the federal regulatory agencies, the Samuelson report on the prospect of our national economy indicate this, that though Mr. Kennedy speaks the language of the New Deal, he does not intend to wield the surgery which the New Deal practiced on our economy, but rather to speak their language of human welfare and to meet the problems of social legislation as they come up pragmatically, directly, rather than to trust the time cure all philosophy which was prevalent during the past administration. There will be changes, basic changes in the American economy. There will be changes which will be directed towards particular problems rather than changes directed towards an overhauling, a total renovation of the organization of our economic and social life. One of the first pieces of legislation which Mr. Kennedy will undoubtedly submit to the Congress will be a bill to grant federal relief to the elderly to help them meet their medical needs. He submitted such a bill in that ill-fated and ill-advised rump session of Congress which was hastily convened after the summer nominating conventions. It was defeated there as because it was a political football. It will not be defeated now. Over 15 million Americans, elderly Americans, retired Americans, subsist on Social Security or less. They are faced with the inevitability of debility and geriatric disease. And their meager capital is not sufficient to give them an anchor to leeward against the storm. They need help. They have needed help for some time. And despite the cries of some medical politicians that such federal aid is a form of socialism, some such program of help will be devised and will be granted to them. The American people will see that the medical gift of prolonged life be a gift of life which is endurable, bearable, not one beyond the capacity of the infirm to adjust to and to accept. The other elements of Mr. Kennedy's social program have yet to be defined. If he follows out, and I believe he will, the lines indicated in his campaign, these will include federal aid to education, a hiking of the minimum wage level, some bills relating to the field of civil rights, labor reform, and conservation. Much has been spoken of a honeymoon between the President and the new Congress, a period of time when the working majority of Democrats in both sides of the Congress, in both houses of the Congress, will unite with their Democratic President to push through various bills which they mutually agreed to in their Democratic National Platform, and all those bills which I have indicated were submitted in that platform. I doubt that such a honeymoon will be of long duration. None of these bills, as they now are proposed, will receive eagerly and easily the assent of many of the Democrats and of many of the Republicans in the Congress. To take only one and perhaps the most pressing example, the bill which proposes to give federal aid to our public school systems. A task force led by the president of Purdue University, Mr. Hovde, submitted to the new president a report in which they worked out the support which it was felt the federal government should give to local school systems. Local school systems, it was indicated, have labored manfully to meet the pupil boom and the rising cost of wages and prices. But if they are to continue to give the kind of education to the young people of America which they have traditionally sought to give, they will require a minimum of $30 per pupil per year as support and subvention from the federal treasury. No longer can our public school systems expect to sustain themselves entirely from the local tax duplicates. Their financial base is simply too meager. Will such support be available? It will certainly be proposed. But in Congress, it will meet the attack of the Catholic Church. Cardinal Francis Spellman has already indicated that the Catholic Church considers such a bill discriminatory. For it is a bill for federal aid to public education. It includes no provision for private school education, parochial school education. And he holds that this is to discriminate against the private parochial schools of the church. And he will be joined in this by many a Southern politician who would be all too delighted to see a new bill written permitting federal aid to the private schools, for if such aid is available, he is eager to establish throughout the Southland a series of segregated private schools, a series of schools whose intent and sole function would be to subvent and suborn the intent of the desegregation decision of our Supreme Court. No, Mr. Kennedy's proposals will not be easily passed into law, and it will be a test of his courage, his conviction, and his political acumen to see that they are pushed through, that they are written into the law of our land. What of the international scene, the area which Mr. Kennedy himself chose to devote his entire attention to in the inaugural address? Why did he so devote his time? Was he unconcerned with the immediate problems of our domestic economy? Quite the contrary. But surely we all recognize that the overarching problem of today is war or peace. The best laid laws and regulation and plans of our politician go up in atomic smoke. War infests our land. The speech was a firm, outstanding definition, both the positive and the purposeful aspects of our intended foreign policy. As he outlines it, it begins with a traditional policy of deterrence, arms second to none, a defense position equal to any challenge which may be hurled to it. This is familiar territory to all of us. It has been the line of the American executive since the end of the Second World War. But then, with a clarity which is unusual in executive pronouncements, he went on to outline the more positive elements of a peace program which he intended to persecute. Aid to the underdeveloped and undernourished countries of the world, not because the communists do it, not because we seek their votes, but because it is right. A support of the United Nations, because it is the shield of the weak, because it is our last great hope for a convocation of governments seeking mutually to establish international law. A willingness to meet and to negotiate with the Russians wherever purposeful negotiations can be undertaken, for only through such discussion is there any hope of adjusting the complicated political checkerboard which faces the world. And these negotiations are to include arms control and disarmament, the possible dismembering of our machine of murder and theirs, for in that dismemberment alone is there any hope for a sustained period of civilization. Now, none of this is new. It's not only that it's been said before from this pulpit. President Eisenhower said it often, especially in the last years of his administration. What is new is the forcefulness with which it was said. Mr. Eisenhower was always caught with his hands tied behind his back. His administration was halting between two opinions. He spoke of peace, and his admirals and his generals and his Atomic Energy Commission spoke of war. He brought us to Geneva. Admiral Strauss saw to it that at Geneva, the portfolios of our ambassadors were portfolios of propaganda. Why so? Part because President Eisenhower was the inheritor of the first 4 or 5 years of his administration, where the psychology was one of containment and brinkmanship, the building up of our arms, and where little, if nothing, was said of adjustment, coexistence, and compromise. In part because he did not have clear control of the senior statesmen in the various departments of his administration or in the Pentagon. Most surprising of all the speeches made in the change of administrations was the valedictory submitted by the president, ex-president, to the American people. He spoke not so much of the accomplishments of his administration, but of the dangers which he foresaw for the future. And he spoke of a danger which was as surprising as it was enlightening. Let me read you a few paragraphs from the radio television address, which was Mr. Eisenhower's last address to the American people as their president. A vital element in keeping the peace is our military establishment. Our arms must be mighty, ready for instant action, that no potential aggressor may be tempted to risk his own destruction. Our military organization today bears little relation to that known by any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea. Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United Nations had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But now we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent arms industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security more than the net income of all United States corporations. This conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or our democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial military machine of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security, liberty, both may prosper. Now, these are not the hallucinations of some radical muckraker. This is the warning, the valedictory, the supreme warning of a man who served us and served us well as our president for 8 years. Now, what did he in mind? Was he only concerned of occasional collusion in matters of contract? Congress has been concerned with that problem for several years now, and it has enacted, as you know, several provisions concerning the retirement employment of ex-high-level Pentagon officials. No, Mr. Eisenhower's concern lies much deeper, and it is born of sad experience, of his own sad experience. Men whose profession is that of war, men whose financial advantage lies in the arms preparation which underlies war, men whose whole life, whose every interest is involved in the techniques of war and the refinement of war materiels, these men inevitably think with a wartime philosophy along warring terms. And they fear the risks of peace. And they are unable to comprehend the necessity of a differing peace philosophy, one which is not so much concerned with working out every wrinkle in some new armaments proposal as it is with working out every wrinkle which disturbs and troubles communication and understanding between the nations of our world. It is altogether understandable how the men of our armaments industry and the men of our Pentagon are leery of these programs of coexistence and peace. They involve a reduction of our powers of defense. Certainly they do. Were we to establish a program of arms control and disarmament, we would be less strong rather than more strong in a purely physical sense. But we would have more of a chance for peace rather than less of a chance for peace. In an era where war itself is defeat, where war means the annihilation of all that we know and prize, and where war is inevitable, given an unending, unceasing continuation of our arms race, we must somehow find a way to control, as the president indicates, to curb the concern and the propaganda and the public relations and the releases of these public speaking admirals and generals and commissioners, so that they will not fear cause the American people to be frightened, that they will not sound away at that age-old theme of Russian perfidy as the excuse for not reaching any communication or any convention with them. Now, these men still exist in our government. They are good men. It's very easy to confuse your own basic interests with a national interest, especially when your interests are concerned only with strengthening American defenses. Mr. Kennedy has already come into conflict with one of these men, the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Arleigh Burke. Just yesterday, it was announced that he had censored and ordered, not delivered, a saber-rattling speech of Admiral Burke, which had no particular purpose at this delicate time in international negotiation. Mr. Kennedy has this advantage over Mr. Eisenhower, that again, though they speak and hope for the same ends, same positive, peaceful foreign policy ends, he has a greater chance because of his youth and his energy and because of the newness of his administration to force and coerce his senior officialdom to speak with one voice, a voice united, the policy which is determined upon by the president and by his advisors. Surely he needs to place before the confused American people a single point of view, one which we can reflect on and adjust to and ultimately accept. It would be tragic if a divided America must face a united Russia across the conference table. And then Mr. Kennedy, once he has united his government behind his own well-stated views, he must make these views self-evident to the American people. We have, in a sense, been brainwashed over the past 15 years. We have been spoken to fear. We have been made anxious. We have been told of the necessity of defense. We have been given a philosophy of armament. We have been spoken to of deterrence and containment. You cannot overnight transform the fears of the American people, and many of them are legitimate fears, unless you spend a great deal of energy acquainting the American people with the reasons for this shift in policy, from the negative to the positive, from war to peace, from armaments to moral rearmament, from world disorder to world law. Then, of course, he faces the supreme test, the test of patience, of courage, and of understanding. He must meet the exasperating, difficult, oft-times petulant Russians. He must never lose his equanimity. He must never fear to meet them on their own terms. He must seek to understand the reasons that motivate their policy, why they are fearful of a united Germany, why they cannot accept a Europe united around a new central German power, why, too, they are eager to make arrangements with us now for disarmament, especially nuclear disarmament, fearful as they are of the nuclear arming of Chuen Lai, of Red China. Fortunately, Mr. Kennedy comes to office in a period where conversation is possible. Mr. Khrushchev sent as his calling card to the new administration the two remaining crewmen of the RB-52. Since May of last year, since the U-2 cascaded out of the Russian skies, there has been no conversation between Moscow and Washington. There is conversation now. There will be a disarmament meeting sometime in the spring, probably in March in Geneva. There has been arrangement between our two governments on certain matters of mutual interest. Mr. Khrushchev is as eager as Mr. Kennedy to move carefully and deliberately into these areas. He has his own reasons, and they are not ours. And they ought never to be confused with ours. They are as selfish as ours are selfish. But ultimately, they resolve and revolve around this cardinal point, that he too and his government has come to realize that as much as he contemns capitalism, he must learn to live with it. The alternative is to destroy the communism which he adores. War is itself defeat. And he knows as well as we know that if in the next 5 or 10 years the atomic club is enlarged, as inevitably it will be, and if Mr. Nasser and Mr. Lumumba and Mr. Castro begin to brandish atomic warheads and atomic missiles, there is little hope of world peace. There's little hope now. There's none. That comes into being. And he knows, too, that all the immediate political problems which trouble our world, Laos, the Congo, problems of Latin America, all these can be solved if every political problem is not immediately magnified to atomic proportions. There will always be political problems, but they can be met. They can be met sensibly by a world assembly and not by threat, the threat of ultimate Armageddon. Mr. Kennedy's road is a difficult one. He deserves not only our hope, but our prayers and our united support. I would not like, I am sure none of you would enjoy being freighted with the responsibility for American decision and policy. In this day of ultimate decisions, where the wrong decision can mean destruction. It is a weight which must be carried with humility and with understanding, which someone must bear, which he who bears it must enjoy the united approbation and support of his nation. I believe that Mr. Kennedy has a great deal of the understanding, certainly that he has a view of the long range involvements which he is undertaking. I approved especially that paragraph in his speech which said, all this will not be achieved in the first 100 days of this administration, nor will it be achieved in the first 1,000 days, nor perhaps even in the lifetime of this administration, nor will it be perhaps achieved in our lifetime upon this planet. Let us begin. Work, peace. The work of reconciliation. The work of adjustment must be begun. He will lead us in the days ahead to its beginning. And as he does, he deserves our support, our encouragement, and our prayers.